on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Oh my God, I can't believe it.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Welcome to another edition of
Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times.
That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Welcome to another edition of the Happiness Algorithm with myself, James Roast. The show that talks all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us that little bit happier. Now, my guest today is a psychologist, author, and fellow podcast host. She has spent her career working with some of the world's most successful business leaders and prominent individuals from across many different industries and platforms. More recently, she has combined this experience with a focus on sharing psychological principles with a broader population. She is on a mission to use her knowledge and expertise to make our lives just a bit better, easier and healthier. My guest believes passionately that psychology can be an invaluable resource, part of an everyday toolkit that we have available to help us understand our own and others' behavior and how we can positively influence it. She launched the podcast Dot to Dot Behind the Person as a body dedicated to this work, and you can listen back to previous episodes on all good podcast platforms. Not only does my guest positively shift and cultivate a better world for us all to live in, she has even found the time to document her knowledge and write two exceptional books, Defining You and Mirror Thinking, Why Role Models Make Us Human. To explore and delve into that wonderful brain of hers a little more, please welcome to the show, Fiona Murden. Fiona, how are you?
Oh, thank you for that introduction, James. I'm good, thank you. Yeah, great. It's a nice day, September, still sun shining.
Yep. It is, yeah, we've got to welcome this little blast of warm weather that we're having at the minute. Now, I almost feel embarrassed to be asking this, but we must sort of set sail in the way that we always do here on the Happiness Algorithm, and I invite the guest to share a little bit about who they are, what they do, and how they've arrived at this point. Because, and the reason I feel slightly embarrassed is because if people are not aware who Fiona is, then I must ask, have you been living on Mars? But please pardon the question, but Fiona, would you share a little bit about yourself?
That's very kind, but I think maybe I've been living on Mars, so no one knows. Quick whiz bang, did psychology undergraduate, did masters in business because I didn't think I could cope with clinical side of psychology, went into work as a business consultant, working at London Stock Exchange and then moving to Sony PlayStation and Disney, but realised it was still the people that I was interested in, not the processes, not the all the other aspects. And so I went back to university and did my MSc in occupational psychology with the aim of becoming a chartered psychologist. And that was, I thought, that way I could use the experience I'd gained. By then it was 4 years in business plus my first master's in business and focus on the psychology, but stay more in the positive side of psychology, simply because I personally didn't have the emotional resilience to do the sort of work that you do, which I have huge admiration for.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I'm sure you do and have. But equally, I suppose for many, it would be interesting to hear that there are these different forms of psychology, and that it's not a one size fits all, and that we can navigate or you know, pursue different paths in that area.
I think that's really true. And it's interesting because I still think psychology largely sits on the outskirts. So it'd be educational psychology is helping children who are struggling. Clinical psychology is helping people who are struggling. Criminal psychology, obviously, an outlier in the population. Sports psychology is working mainly with people who are high-performing athletes. Health psychology, potentially more in the general population. And then the population I've worked with has been leaders. And that's always felt slightly wrong to me. I find them fascinating. I find it really interesting trying to help them understand the people around them and themselves and how that fits within the organisational context. But I've always thought, when I've been doing that work, what about everyone else? If these people need my help, what about, you know, Joe Bloggs? What about people who aren't seeing a clinical psychologist or a therapist, just people living normal lives? And that's really where I came to with wanting to write the books, because I thought, you know, I've accumulated this knowledge and I don't think it should just be leaders who are getting the benefits of it.
Mm. Has the way you practice evolved and changed from when you set out and started working with these you know, huge corporations and the leaders that are dictating a lot of their movement to where you find yourself now?
I think the thing is, and I'm sure you find this too, James, is there are so many different approaches and there's so much research going on all the time that you're always learning and building on not only your own body of experience and having sort of put that into practice, but also learning about new thoughts, it can be from a neuroscientific perspective right through to a therapy perspective. I'm sure you've come across ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. And I wasn't aware of that until I did my second master's, which, you know, I'd studied psychology for a while then. And I hadn't really, I did a couple of courses on it after my MSc, but I hadn't really understood it fully until probably the last few years. And it's just a wonderful approach to helping people, not just people who are stuck, but actually just to enable creativity and help us to manage our emotions more effectively. And so I think, I wouldn't ever say that I would only use one approach. I think there are different approaches, there's different knowledge, and it all applies in different ways at different times.
Absolutely, I agree. And I think that ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, like you, came to it reasonably late, or it sort of gained traction probably more so in the last sort of 8 to 10 years. And I think it's a wonderful model and philosophy. And actually, I mean, we could spend an entire show discussing it, actually. But I think that it almost is more accessible and relatable now, as the world in which we find ourselves is becoming more and more demanding. And so understanding that it's not a one size fits all, that there are aspects of our existence, there's contribution, there's always going to be an element of discomfort and distress and how we manage that. So I would definitely urge everybody to do that. I'll go down another road if we keep talking in that way. I was going to say, as you and I know, we could quite easily just talk for hours and hours and hours, as we have done many a time. So, I suppose we should start where you started in terms of interest in psychology, moving into the world of leadership and business. What's your take on leaders and how they influence culture and who we are?
I mean, leaders it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a really broad term. Because you can have thought leaders, you can have political leaders. There are leaders of organizations and corporate leaders of nonprofits. And I think depending on what situation they're in, they can massively influence culture. And if we take, am I allowed to talk about Trump? Because I did a TV show recently and they told me I couldn't talk about Trump.
Yeah, talk about Trump.
Yeah. So there's something I talk about in Mirror Thinking, my latest book, which is called The Trump Effect. And I didn't come up with that term, someone else did. But looking at the increase in hate crime and racism, this is all being done through proper sort of statistical analysis of various different data sets when Trump came to power is quite horrendous. And whilst you also see the sort of the backlash against Trump in the States and this huge divide at the moment, you can see how a leader in a position who's elected in a position of power or who's put in a position of power through being promoted into a role can have a huge impact on few people who work for them through to millions of people. And that's partly because of the way we've evolved, because we evolved to look to the person who has expertise or prestige to show us how to do things. And we don't single out certain behaviours. We see things globally in terms of how our brain works, as you know. You know, we just, if we're sitting and rationally looking at it, we might say, well, I wouldn't like to imitate that aspect of that person, but I would imitate that aspect. But generally, we take it from a much more holistic perspective and our brain just takes the whole thing.
Mm. Are there common traits or characteristics that you've identified over the years in successful leaders?
Well, that's interesting because I looked at emotional resilience years ago because one of the things I do is profile senior leaders. So say there's people want a CEO for a role and they'll get them down to the last two in terms of candidates, and then I might do a 4-hour in-depth psychological profile. And I can't claim it was my idea. It was someone I'd worked with years ago who was a CEO who wanted me to hire other people into his company, and he said, Fiona, I think we need to look at emotional resilience. And although I'd come across it as a term, I hadn't used it in that context, and this was, I don't know, 13-14 years ago. And so every single profile I did, I looked at that individual's emotional resilience, and it wasn't to say whether someone was going to snap or not, but to say what was their tank full of, if you like, if they have a fuel tank, which were the things that would fuel up their tank and which were the things that were going to deplete that tank. And leaders do tend to have a high level of emotional resilience. Good leaders have a high level of self-awareness. Bad leaders can become hubristic, which is, you know, narcissistic, omnipotent type of attitude towards the world. So they tread a very fine line on a lot of these things. And I think hubris is one example of where you can quickly tip from being a good leader to being a bad, very bad leader because you shut yourself off from the reality of the world that you're operating in.
And is there a cause or contributing factors as to why a bad leader would end up doing that? I suppose that's quite a broad question, and I'm sure there are individual qualities that contribute, but is there a sort of common theme that would cause someone that has the potential to be a great or a good leader, an influencer, to then actually becoming more narcissistic, or would those traits have to be there?
Well, they don't actually. There's, I mean, Lord David Owen, who wrote a paper on this. I believe he was a psychiatrist as well as a lord. And he looked at hubristic leaders in the UK and the US over the last 100 years. So this was, he did it 10 or so years ago. And he said it was the only acquired personality disorder. So whereas other personality disorders, they might be triggered. So something like depression or schizophrenia or what have you might be triggered. This is actually something that could be be sort of like almost like you go to the shop and you buy it, but it's not that, it's in terms of leadership. And he gives the example of Blair and how Blair was a very good leader, whether you agreed with his politics or not. And then he got to a point where he just shut off. He thought he was so great. He stopped listening to his advisors, potentially, or potentially people were only telling him what he wanted to hear. And he started losing touch with reality.
Yeah. You know what it makes me think about? Almost a sense of loneliness. As I was writing down, as you were speaking there, some notes, because I suppose as a leader, obviously you will be followed, surrounded by many people or a select few. But there must be an aspect of isolation or loneliness that would go with that as well.
Yeah, and that's actually absolutely true, because when I finished my MSc, I went to work for a firm called, confusingly, YSC, which was a group of psychologists, a mixture. There was some clinical, some educational, some criminal, actually, but had all ended up in the same space. And one of the things that we pulled out was being a leader is lonely. It's a lonely place to be. If you're a founder, that's lonely too, because you don't really have anyone else who's a peer.
And so there lies the importance of that emotional resilience, because we know loneliness and isolation can be extremely debilitating and can cause sort of an internal havoc. You know, there's enough literature and paper on it that says loneliness is a killer as such. But I suppose the leader, the strong or the good leaders as such, in inverted commas, have a high level of self-awareness, understanding, good level of emotional resilience, and therefore can tolerate the discomfort that comes with that.
Yeah, I would say that's right. And I think obviously it's different for different leaders in different situations. But there's one guy that I work with who's vice chancellor of a university. And he disagrees with academia being siloed, and he really sort of stirs things up, mixes things up and does things differently, goes against what government might want and all that sort of stuff. So he's fighting a lonely battle a lot of the time. But he's very self-aware, and he knows things, for example, like he does a lot of international travel because they have a lot of international students. And he knows that if he's done long-haul flights, he needs time to recuperate. Otherwise, he doesn't perform well. But you know how easy it is that if someone else is looking after your diary, things just get put in there. But he's very, very clear on these parameters. And he tells the people around him, in terms of the people that report to him, tell me if I seem tired, because he's aware that we miss those signals when we're tired, because we become less self-aware, don't we? So that's just one example of some of the things he's put in place around him to make sure that he doesn't slip. And in that sense, it's with tiredness, but the same needs to be true with all sorts of things. So that you know you're getting honest feedback. You're not just hearing what people think you should hear, or because you know, feedback, even if it's bad, is part of existing as a human in a community. And without that, that's where I think you can lose touch.
You're right. I think that, you know, without that feedback, we prevent ourselves from sort of evolving or growing further, because we're all going to carry blind spots no matter how much self-awareness or attention we give to self. There's always going to be bits that we miss, and that 360 degree feedback from others is crucial. I suppose the other bit mentioned, as you touch on that chap there, what occurred to me was there's something about owning vulnerabilities too. So if I'm tired, let me know. If I'm missing something, let me know. And I suppose that comes through in that good leadership as well, recognizes that, I've said it before, but the beauty of being a human being is that we're imperfect creatures. But what And that's appealing in a leadership. Me personally speaking, you know, as a leader would be someone that would be, would own their vulnerabilities, would have a good level of self-awareness and take ownership of that. And obviously this, a big part of this does come, and I urge anybody to go out and purchase it, in defining you. There's, you know, it's about how we can refine who we are in that sort of hedonistic, hectic, demanding world. And is that where, you know, through those experiences, defining you came from, through those opportunities and the work that you've done, is that what ignited the desire to produce Defining You?
So I actually wrote another book before Defining You that's not been published. And Defining You came about, it's a long story how it came about, but yes, the root is basically trying to translate the experience of profiling and then coaching into something that anybody can pick up and use. And clearly it's not exactly the same, and you're sitting with a book's very different from sitting with a person, but it's aimed at introducing some of the tools. So being curious, understanding how your brain works, understanding how that impacts how you work. But also it gives mechanisms for asking for feedback in nice, friendly, gentle ways, which, you know, it's all sorts of things that I've pulled together from all sorts of different places. So it's not just me saying, right, this is how you should do this. It's me saying, this person is an expert in this. Have a look at it. And now let's go on to the next bit of your story. And this person would suggest you look at this. What does that look like? And I tried to write it in a way that was really carefully, wouldn't lead anyone down any rabbit holes and leave anyone feeling stuck without help, because that's really not good. And it is slightly more business focused than I would have liked it to have been, because I really wanted it to be not business, but work focused. I really wanted it just to be for everyone in everyday life. But, you know, when you're doing something like writing a book, they have a market that they're interested in, that you write to, as it were.
Mm. Did you feel at all compromised by that? Or are you happy with what you've conveyed?
I'm happy.
Because I think it is accessible.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I'm happy with what I conveyed. At the time, I felt like it felt like documenting what I do, which didn't feel like a creative process to an extent, which I'm now looking at it was, because I had to sort of think through how I was going to convey things in terms of language and all that sort of stuff. But I think my second book was more, actually it's more hedonistic for me, or because it was more an exploration and sort of storytelling and that sort of approach. The first one's a how-to, if you like, and the second one's a look at the world.
There's two words you've used that I think that we should all adopt much more freely in our vocabulary, but in our sort of intrinsic self, and that's be curious, or curiosity, and exploration. And I think sometimes the world in which we exist in prevents us or stifles that need to encourage curiosity, exploration of self, where we're sitting, what we're feeling, trusting in intuition. So I would definitely advocate both those words, that curiosity and exploration. Do you think this is, am I barking up the wrong tree, or do you think these are crucial for our own well-being and where we're at?
Absolutely. And there's evidence that people actually live longer if they're more curious. There was a big study carried out. It's not just some wacky idea. followed people up after a certain period of time, and the ones that were less curious just died. It's quite dramatic. But it's been shown to be very, very helpful to our well-being, supporting our well-being. And curiosity also has been shown by, I think it was Sophie Van Stom at Edinburgh University, now I might have remembered that wrong, did a study which showed curiosity was as important as IQ in terms of approaching problem solving. And that makes sense to me, because if we go back to the leaders, one thing I used to have a problem with was we were expected to measure their verbal, numerical, and abstract reasoning. And I would say, why are you doing this? Because, you know, these people are clearly capable from where they've got to. And some people, even CEOs, would score very low on these, that suggest that they wouldn't be past 16 at school, not because, you know, not because they chose to drop out, but because they had to drop out type thing. Which is where I get really cross about IQ and schooling, and I won't go down that one, but I think it's really narrow and it doesn't measure someone's full potential. But when you're looking at leaders, you do look at them more broadly and you say, how curious are you? How situationally intelligent are you? How emotionally intelligent are you? How empathic are you? How able are you to show your vulnerabilities but still own your confidence? And all those different nuanced facets make up a human being and make up who we are. And one of the fundamentals about humans is that we're curious. And I think you're right. I think the world does shut it down. Social media shuts it down because we're fed what we already look for, if that makes sense.
Yes. Well, I think we've done quite well to get to 26 minutes into the show and just get onto social media. I thought we were going to hit this much earlier. But before we go onto it, because I do want to speak about social media, I want to pitch it after I've asked this question, which is, how important are leaders, and do we need leaders in society and the cultures in which we live?
That's quite a deep question to throw there, James.
Sorry, it just came to me.
Thanks. Well, from an evolutionary perspective, it was believed that our ancient ancestors would have quite an egalitarian setup, but there'd be different people would lead in different situations, but there would always be someone leading. I believe this is what the research shows. So, for example, the best hunter would be the leader on the hunt. The best farmer would be the person who farmed, although farming wasn't ancient ancestors, of course. So the best forager, say, would be the person who people look to for that. And so, but the way we look to leaders was we'd look to them through respect and through their expertise and their knowledge. In the modern world, the same should be true in that, of course, we need someone to steer the ship. We need someone to tell us which way to go. Otherwise, we could just end up going round and round circles. But the way we choose that person and the standards that they are held to are not the same as they would have been from an evolutionary perspective.
Mm. Yes, because then that but that brings us onto social media. And I know we've spoken about this off air many a times. And, you know, it is both a blessing and a curse in the sense that it provides a platform. It gives individuals a voice. But I often wonder whether it's useful. Oh, it's a controversial statement I'm going to make here. It is useful for everybody to have a voice. Now, I'm going to add a little more to that before people start, throwing stones at me in the street. What I mean by that is it's provided a platform where we can be quite reactive and impulsive. When we are having a conversation or we're in a debate with somebody and it provokes us emotionally in a certain way, we may feel agitated or upset by what has been said, and the processes, the emotional and psychological processes in how we respond to that situation are multifaceted. There are many, many dimensions to it. And so we, again, because we're underpinned by existence, relationship underpins our existence and we're social creatures, we don't want to sort of compromise our sense of safety in the tribe or the pack, as it were. So all of these components work together, and then we formulate a response, which may be that we you know, let it pass, or we regulate our emotional response, or we may say something back, but it's an informed decision that we make. Whereas perhaps from a social media perspective, we can ping things off without giving them much consideration or thought. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, totally. We talked about the dinner party before, didn't we, or the pub dinner. Mm. It's like if you're having, I know we don't do this sort of thing anymore because of COVID, but in the days when we used to sit around a table and have a pub lunch with sort of different groups of friends, if someone said something that we disagree with, firstly, we're going to look to read how they meant it. We're going to look to read how others in the group interpret it. Things that we're not actually consciously thinking about, but we're reading the situation, we're reading the nuance, and then we make a decision on whether we're going to respond, whether we're going to let it play out, what people will think of us if we say something in opposition. So we don't immediately shout someone down if we disagree with them. We let it play out a little bit and we look at it. And then even then, if we still disagree with them, we've probably by then had a bit of thinking about it and thought, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I should say that because Jim will think I'm X or Sophie will think I'm Y. But when we're on social media, we have nothing, none of that around us, none of those cues, like you say, none of those nuances. And we also don't, we can't read the nuance that's been put into the statement that's upset us. So if you think about the word hello, you can go, hello, 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 hello. And just, you know, just there's a few ways you can say hello and they all have a different meaning to them. But if you write down hello, that's all it means.
So it becomes almost, it's completely unfiltered. All of those, as you say, those processes and mechanisms that we do at the dinner party, at the pub lunch, they're the filters that it has to pass through before we get this refined output. Whereas from a social media perspective, it's just raw output with no, well, no refinement.
And raw input as well, because people might not mean something that they've written in the way that it comes across. It's just like if you write a text message to a friend or an email, we become quite task-oriented when we're writing things as well.
Yeah.
Which means that we take the emotion away. And I think that means we don't consider other people's emotions so much. It's like when, I mean, so given that I'm a psychologist and given that I really deeply care about people, and that's why I felt I couldn't do clinical because I'd go too much into other people's emotions, I still have to remind myself to go back to the beginning of my emails once I've written them and go, how are you?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you write an email, you're in task mode. Well, I am. So I like rattle off an email and I'm about to send it. I think, oh my goodness, I haven't even said, how are you? Or how is your weekend or anything like that. So it's, and social media is like that, but it's even less personal because it's not necessarily one-to-one. You're typing it into a computer or a screen.
Mm. And so has it or does it create almost false leaders?
Well, I think that's really interesting. I think it's something you raised when we spoke last week. And I think, yes, it has, but it also means that people don't know who to listen to because suddenly you don't need to be trained with 15 years experience to offer advice, for example. You can just have lots of followers. But does that make you qualified to offer psychological advice? And there's a nuance, isn't there, we talked about, because obviously for me, the role model piece is important because of I've written about it, but you have someone like Prince Harry or Davina McCall who will stand up for mental health, which is great because that's role modeling the fact that they own their own vulnerabilities and they own the fact that they've sought help or whatever. But that's different from then offering advice to other people. And that's where I think the line gets blurred as well, because those people don't then say, oh, if you're feeling like this, you should do X, Y, and Z. And I'm not saying people shouldn't offer their opinion and their stories and what impacted them and how, but it all gets confused. And so we end up just listening to these voices that are coming left field that actually are not helpful, evidence-based, experience-based, anything like that.
Yeah, and I suppose in the world of social media as well, there's only a percentage of the individual that you're having access to, which are the stories or the snapshots. We have discussed it, and I think it can be dangerous. I think that individuals that have lived experience offer an enormous amount of full stop. An individual with 10, 15, 20, 30 years clinical experience offer an awful lot, full stop. But it's making sure that the individual themselves understands the depth at which that what is offered is understood, and in what context and format that someone portraying, that has lived experience and shares that, I advocate that. I'm for that, because I think that
in effect, that's what my podcast is behind the person.
Yeah.
So it's, for example, Jono McMullen, who's I can't remember his exact title, but he's in the Australian Air Force, and he suffers from PTSD, and he tells his story, and so many people have reached out on that. It's been so immensely helpful. And for a start, I can't offer advice on PTSD because I'm not a clinical psychologist. But secondly, he's not saying, this is what happened to me, therefore you should go and do X, Y, and Z. He's saying, this is what happened to me, and this is how I dealt with it. And then it allows other people to then make their own mind about what they do with that information.
Absolutely. And again, on here, on the happiness algorithm too, it's sharing the narrative of the individual to enable others that are going through a period of crisis or discomfort or struggling in some way to recognize that they're not on their own. And it goes, I suppose, we go back to those intrinsic, strong, important characteristics of the leader. And like the chap you mentioned before about recognizing vulnerabilities in self and asking for that feedback. And I think for a lot of people, from whether it be a mental health perspective or non-diagnosed or clinical, any of us that are struggling, is that it will be okay, that we're not in it on our own, and there is help out there, and it's accessing and finding the right help. And I think the risk is on the social media side of things, is that we can end up reaching out into a world that we believe will provide us with the answers, but actually can make us feel a hell of a lot worse. Whereas actually internally, the answers will be there. We can find support in the outside world, and align ourselves with that. But at times it's dicing with some dangerous principles.
Yeah, and it's such a nuance, isn't it? Because even when you're saying it now, it's like thinking, yeah, of course, we want to hear that we're not in it on our own. I've had clinical depression, and I know that at the time I was diagnosed, it was much quieter. People didn't talk about that sort of thing. And I know that if I'd known of other people feeling the same, it would have really helped me. Mm. And, you know, for Jono's story with the PTSD, the number of servicemen and women that have come and said, thank you for sharing that. A, it means they don't feel like they're weak if they have the same. B, they feel like they're normal if they have the same, because it helps us understand what's normal and what's not. And it also helps us feel connected, because, like you said, going back to the point of feeling lonely, we need to feel connected to other human beings. It's so important to our mental health. And part of that is knowing other people's stories. But then the advice piece is different. And that's, I think that's where it gets slightly muddled.
It does. And I think that for me is where it's important for the individual to not disconnect or lose sight of themselves, or lose their voice in that not explicit period of recovery, but that journey back to a position of relative stability, because I think that's all we can ever hope for. Not being a doom monger, but life is about reaching periods of relative stability, because the one certainty with life is its uncertain nature, its unpredictability. There will always be difficult periods. There will always be situations that are quite spontaneous and, you know, we haven't accounted for. And in between those periods, there's a period of relative stability that leaves us and should leave us feeling quite content and happy, I suppose. I think it's the individual not feeling as though somebody else has all of the answers for them.
Yeah, totally. Because even like with me, with leaders, with you, with the people you work with, I'm sure you'd say, we don't have all the answers either, because mm-mm. everyone's different. And we could offer 10 different flavors of ice cream, but that person may try them all and only like one flavor. Well, they then know they like that flavor and they stick with that flavor. But we need to be able to offer them the right type of ice cream and not poison, if you like, or something that's going to upset their tummy. And we know that our 10 flavors of ice cream have been tested on other people and they haven't died. You know, that's a silly example, but you know what I'm saying? I think
I like it. I like it. I like ice cream, and I think we will stick like with it that.
Because I was getting a bit lost on that one.
But I think it's right.
So yeah, and I think we have to learn ourselves, and one of the jobs of being a parent is trying to learn our children, and we can't fully learn them and we can't fully know them. And that's one thing I struggled with my eldest daughter for quite a few years, not anymore. She was different from me, so I didn't get how she could be different from me because she was my daughter, which is crazy, you know. But actually, I've learnt her now, and she'll change because she's a teenager. And we all change all the time. We evolve, we shift, but it's understanding ourselves as much as we can. And that's not introspecting, it's observing. And that's another place, there's a fine line. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, James, but I think self-awareness, for example, it's not about sitting and contemplating and getting yourself in a whole muddle because you're introspecting about the world. It's about observing. It's saying, how does that make me feel? Oh, that's interesting. With a light touch. And then using that information to say, do you know what? When I'm around that person, I always feel a bit, why is that? Actually, if I listen to the way they talk to me, they put me down. What am I going to do about that? Maybe I won't spend so much time with them. Or maybe I'll point out to them that they do that. And so it's that sort of light observation of what's going on in and around us.
I love that. Light touch. I agree. Observation. Often I find myself using the phrase a soft analysis. So it embodies that curiosity again, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Feel that, again, we go back to parenting. I think it's a really good sort of example to use that in this hectic sort of hedonistic demanding world in which we live, we've been raised on almost a super nanny approach, you know, pure behaviorism, you know, sitting on the naughty step, blah, 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 and that. But we're more than just behaviorally driven creatures. We're more than sort of those conditioned creatures. There is emotion, there is cognition, there is thought behind it. And if we're not, observing, so when we notice and when we're aware of those subtle, as you say, nuances and internal changes emotionally, I don't think we can really respond in an informed or a robust way. So it does become task orientated or task driven again, which doesn't provide any longevity or any hope of relative stability and happiness or contentment again. So and I see that a lot in parenting. I think parenting has almost become a to-do, you know, that we often, are our children walking, talking, reading, bottle-fed, breastfed, what level are they on, are they swimming yet, are they, and it's this competition that has bred through life that is quite tragic because it should be much more organic than that.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel really strongly about that. And it comes back to the education piece where I live. We have the 11 plus. And I feel really strongly about the 11 plus. I've actually fallen out with people about it. And I don't usually fall out with people because I like people to like me. I just think it judges a child on the wrong measures. But But I think that's where we've got a lot of stuff wrong in the UK, where countries like Finland have got it right in that they don't even test children till they're 16, I think, in any capacity. And they still have one of the highest educational attainments in the world. Mm. They let it be more child-centric and child-led. And I think the thing is, I find, you know, as a parent, you do want to solve things and you do want to find the answers and you do want to help. But sometimes it's just about listening. And, you know, sometimes a child can't name their emotion or they can't understand what they're feeling and they can't articulate it. But that's okay too. It's just being with them and letting them know that actually that's okay.
Mm. I think that fosters and encourages the development of that emotional resilience, because I think that if we as parents or as role models don't sit with our own emotions or become quite reactive with our children when they present or we detect or attune with discomfort, then we almost run the risk of them adopting similar principles and you know, that these emotions are not necessarily wrong, but they're too complicated and we move on, or there must be something we need to do with them
to fix.
Absolutely. And it feeds into that sort of broken, fixed model. And you know,
it's really hard because we've been brought up with this, with this belief that, you know, come on, be happy. I hope you have a happy day.
Yeah.
There's things like that. And I have to catch myself saying it, because I'll say to my kid, I hope you have a happy day. And I think, no, don't say that. I hope you have a good day. Because a good day could mean you have some bad patches and you feel quite sad at sometimes, but that's okay. You don't need to be unhappy the whole time to live a fulfilled life.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think that there's a lot of, there's movement, there is greater movement and a lot more traction being gained with apps and digital platforms that are enabling people to be more aware of the ebbs and flows during the day. And speaking to somebody yesterday, they are using one of these mood tracking apps, and she shared that.
Can you tell me which one afterwards?
I will. I'll tell you off air. And she shared that actually it'd been quite a period of, it'd been a difficult period, and they were all blues when they should be greens. Not should, that summary, I'm saying that. That was what I was led to believe, that it's better to be all green. But there was all these blues. And sadly, and this is the bit that sort of worried me a little bit, the app then instantly sends push messages through that says, these results are indicative of major depression. Do you want to speak to somebody? Yeah, well, that the bit about the major depression bit is what worried me, because they're then being quite, the interpretation of results obviously are going to be indicative of mood being low. That is where I would sort of umbrella how it's populated the results. But that can be quite overwhelming for certain individuals. The reason I'm sharing it is because equally what we said, and as we pulled it apart, we looked at the last 4 or 5 weeks and what life had been like. And it had been really difficult through no fault of the individual. There was a difficulty with work and relationships and so on and so forth. So what we have to understand is that, I share often that there's a mass percentage of our life that is beyond our control, anywhere 70% to 90%. High percentage of our day, our global existence, is beyond our control, which means a ratio of or a swing of 10 to 30 is within our control. So on occasions when we're punching that 90%, it feels like the whole world's against us. So there's a justification and a reason and a right and a cause as to why we've got blues as opposed to greens. And then I suppose the emotional resilience aspect says, well, you know, I understand why I'm feeling the way I am. But yeah, I mean, we could go in a lot of different directions with that, with the digital apps and what they're suggesting.
But James, there's something I don't know if you saw I posted on social media, and I just pulled it up while you're talking, because if you don't mind, can I read something out to you?
Yes, please.
Okay, so this is a quote from a psychiatrist called Dr. Sammy Timimi. He says, we've created with our mental health ideologies a vast sea of people who believe they are broken, who see their emotional intensity as dangerous and as a foreign body needing to be excised, rather than a human experience needing compassion, empathy, and challenge. So, I mean, what I liked about that is it's not critical of the individual in any way, and it's saying, yes, people need compassion, they need empathy, but they also sometimes need a bit of challenge to say, well, okay, you can get through this. That's not you can fight this and you pull your britches up and you'll be okay. But it's and again, it's this nuanced difference. But when we're saying to a lot of people, oh, you've got anxiety, well, of course you've got anxiety. It's a normal human condition to have anxiety.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're broken. It actually means you're working. But then
it does, yeah.
You know, but you don't want massive high levels of anxiety that are immobilizing. But if you believe that even a low level of anxiety means you're broken, then you believe you're broken and you believe there's something wrong with you that needs fixing.
It works at such a dichotomous level, and I think that renders people helpless as well. You know how I work and you know my beliefs, that I worry that at times society has created a broken fixed model or a broken fixed society, and as the psychiatrist there in that tweet sort of encapsulates it perfectly, that we can feel as though we are, you know, we're a leper, we're an outcast because we're experiencing this. And anxiety, depression, whatever the presenting symptoms are, if we look at it in the context of a presenting behavior, there will always be a cause. You know, a baby's temperature will be a result of a cause. Now, if we just keep bringing the temperature down without addressing the cause, temperature will return again. And I think that sometimes we've fallen foul of just treating symptoms. Let's just reduce the anxiety. Let's just, you know, remove the depression. Yeah. Let's feel happier.
And this is where we need to equip people with the tools. And, you know, I'm certainly not fixed. I'm far from fixed. You know, if we go on the broken fixed model, I'm very well and truly broken.
I think we all are.
But, you know, I was talking to this really interesting guy yesterday called Tyler Shores.
Mm.
And we were actually talking about digital well-being. And we're also sort of addressing the same sort of things that we're talking about now and saying that there needs to be more at the front end. So what I always call it is inoculation, not cure.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be looking at how we build up social and emotional skills throughout life into adulthood. We stay curious. We remain self-aware so that we can have a degree of psychological flexibility, which means we don't snap. We don't break. Mm. We bend.
Bend, yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, we might be really bent and we look like we're going to snap, and it's not a very nice place to be. But if we just hang on in there, we know that that will pass too, and we go back to being unbent.
Well, and generally, if we go back to observations, the observations of self, and you know, applying that soft analysis, when we feel that we are about to snap or it feels, you know, intolerable, if we can make those observations, we will be able to see that there are pockets within our control, that we can alter certain aspects within our immediate existence that will alleviate an element of pressure or burden that is causing us to flex and bend so much. And as we provide that little pocket of breathing space, that provides traction, it provides a little bit of grippage to then begin to move forward. And I am with you. And I think, you know, as I said in the intro at the top of the show, it's not creating psychology into this elite form of understanding. It's actually providing a invaluable resource, a toolkit for each and every one of us to have access to and to respond accordingly.
And so what I mean, this is where, why are we taught to read and to write but not how to be human? And I know that sounds ridiculous, because of course we know how to be human, but But we don't. And particularly, so we evolved to, and then I am going to go on to my book is sort of front of mind, but we evolved to learn from other people.
Yes.
Not through written words, not through mathematical algorithms, from watching and listening and then replaying that in our own mind and making sense of it and then replaying it in the real world. That's natural learning. And that social and emotional aspect of learning needs to be highlighted and encouraged in the world we live in, where we don't have those natural opportunities all the time because we are looking at a screen, because kids are looking at a piece of paper rather than up at the world around them.
Mm.
So we need to say, okay, how do we nurture these natural mechanisms for helping people to learn how to be human?
Yeah, I'm scribbling that down. Nurture natural mechanisms. because, it, you know, as you were saying that, it brought to mind a really wonderful article I read she was a psychologist, dyslexic psychologist, and she was talking about her journey through school and how she still carries this horror of a memory about being in primary school, and it was all about achieving a pen license, that you moved on from pencil and were allowed to write in ink. And you know, obviously her being dyslexic, she was very candid and said that it was like climbing Everest, and everyone had a pen license, and she kept asking and asking and asking, and the teacher was like, no, your handwriting's not good enough, it's just not good enough, it's not up to the standard of the mighty pen. And and she talks about it so well, that this legacy that I'll dig it out and I'll forward it on, the legacy that it's left, and how she then entered the world as a early adolescence, into adolescence and even into adulthood, and how it imprinted. Because I think you're right, the reading, the writing, it becomes a clear metric, a clear measure to determine whether you're there or you're there. There or not there, as the case may be, whereas being human and nurturing those natural mechanisms, for me, is where we should be. And I know, you know, I work with schools, but not with the children, but with the teaching staff, and with the focus being on.
Amazing.
Well, it's very kind of you to say, but it's we all need that opportunity to understand, to observe, to apply a level of curiosity and soft analysis, because then I think that the children that we're working with have a much more robust and healthier environment to flex and to be the person that they deserve to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to fulfill. I think every human being has the right to fulfill their potential.
Mm.
And if we're not providing them with, it's not just the reading and the writing and the maths, which some underprivileged areas probably won't get nurtured as much because they've got, you know, parents that aren't there when they get home from school because they have to work long shifts or what have you. But there's also the bit around the social and emotional learning. And, you know, you'll know because you work in schools, the impact. I mean, there was a cabinet report that I could not believe the stat in it. It said it costs the UK government $17 billion a year through the cost is basically because there isn't enough social and emotional learning happening in schools, which has a knock-on impact on life outcomes, work outcomes, mental health, physical health. And so it's just, why are we not doing this?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, it falls into that short-sightedness again, that actually if we put a provision in place that just reduces symptoms, we can tick that box and we move on. But the tragic aspect is that those individuals will keep representing.
Yeah, and then they pass it on to the next generation. And it's not fair on society to measure society on something. You know, I think the problem is with social and emotional learning is we do like to measure things. We like to have numbers, and it's very difficult to measure social and emotional learning.
It is.
It's very, so because we can't measure it, we kind of don't do it.
Yeah, and there lies the argument. just because it's difficult to measure. And then I suppose it comes back to, is it a product that we live in too busy a world? And so people think, well, if we can't do it, then let's just move on. But that can never be the case. It's back that observation and curiosity again. We've got to exploration. We need to then explore how. Was it Einstein that said that, you know, if the animal world judged itself or measured itself in the same way we do, the fish would go through life thinking they're stupid because they can't climb trees. And again, we're applying that mentality to the generations that keep on going. And I suppose even as adults, what you've said, we carry that through. And we're then plagued with this level of competition, which then can play out in or on the social media platforms.
Yeah. I mean, the other issue with social media is there's a lot of research that's incomplete because the data sets keep changing, obviously. But there's one piece of research that looks at empathy levels and shows them declining. And another piece of research that looks at a particular set of, I think it's young 20-something-year-olds, and those that text more and spend more time on their phone have lower levels of empathy. And from a neuroscientific perspective, that makes sense, because to develop and nurture empathy, you have to be experiencing other people's emotions. And obviously we don't experience them to the same intensity, but we mirror them in our own brain, and we have to be interacting with people to be able to do that. And it's like a muscle. It needs to continually be nurtured. It's not just there or not there. And I think these things are so important to society, but also to individuals' own well-being.
Yeah, well, we're in a previous conversation of ours, but I think we've got a touch on Tristan Harris, and I'll do the quote an injustice, so please correct me, but it was about we're dulling down or dumbing the human race down. Please tell me the exact quote if you can pull it.
I've got it open.
Yes.
Tristan Harris, tech is downgrading humans.
Yeah.
It's time to fight back. So Tristan Harris was at Google previously, and he says that it's a race to the bottom of the brainstem with social media, and there's a problem with the attention economy. So basically, I mean, we know this social media taps into our very primitive and quick needs. Need to be liked, clearly the likes, visual stimulation, feeling like we're part of a group, all those sorts of things. And it bypasses the more rational part of our brain. So it's hijacking. And it's the rational part of our brain that helps us to live a more meaningful life, to find meaning and purpose, to understand what our values are. And those things that keep us anchored during the storms of life.
Well, it is.
Wasn't it?
We like thee. We like thee, because I think you touch on there. Well, Fiona, it was only ever going to go one way when we was going to have this conversation. That was going to be deep. But you touched on their values. And I think, again, another important part of that acceptance and commitment therapy philosophy or theory is the importance of understanding values and what we live by. And I think often people are compromised because they're unaware of what their values are. But what they do connect with is the disruption or the frustration they feel in a relationship or in an environment. And it comes down to a misalignment of values. And again, that's okay, because the people in our world should be in our immediate or on our island sharing our space should be those that are adding value. If anybody is not adding the value that we deserve, then we want to kick them off the island as such. But we've got this compromise around we fight with this compromise around evolutionary or from an anthropological perspective, wanting to be liked. So we fear sort of moving people away. But there's too much preoccupation given to making sure that everybody likes us, making sure that we've got all of these multiple thousands and thousands of followers on social media platforms.
Oh, I haven't got one. I haven't got that.
Well, no, nor have I. But sometimes I find people connect and then I kind of wonder why they're connecting with me, because I think that it's odd if our what their page represents as such completely misaligned with what I stand for. And so I can only put it down to the fact that, is it then around numbers, the metric, the data?
Yeah. Oh, well, it's so hard to know, isn't it? And it's so, it's really complex. And the guy I was talking to yesterday, actually, this Tyler Shores, who he's ex-Google as well. And he's doing this big sort of study at Cambridge at the moment on digital wellbeing. And it was interesting talking to him about, I doubt very much, I'm afraid, that Tristan Harris is going to listen to us, James. But he was, I better not say what he was saying. He wasn't saying anything negative, but I shouldn't share other people's views on something. let's change the subject.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, we have set a new record, which I anticipated anyway. So a new record for the happiness algorithm. Normally, as listeners know, we get to about 30 minutes or so and the guest's first song choice is played. We've smashed through the hour mark, and I've not even played one of your song choices. So I think
you don't like my song choices.
No, you know what? I love your song choices, so they will be played. And I think we should play the first one now. So you're listening to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Rose. My special guest is the amazing Fiona Murden. Stick with us here. This is her first song choice. We'll be back after this.
My, riding this moment. Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to The Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. I'm joined by the amazing Fiona Murden today, and that was her first song choice. That was Bon Iver, Skinny Love. That's a brilliant track.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah.
It makes me think of snowboarding, which is my passion.
Ah, okay. So you're a keen snowboarder.
Yeah.
So obviously that track was chosen because you were listening to it last time you was away?
Well, no, actually, it was because, you know, Birdie did a cover of that song.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to listen to the Birdie one when my eldest daughter was little. And then I discovered the Bon Iver one, and I thought, I absolutely love this. I just find it very emotive. Mm. And then when I was on a snowboarding trip with some other girls, and it was quite, you know, it was a good one. It was backcountry splitboarding, all that sort of stuff. And so it was really, you know, hunkering down together in the evenings, and we kept listening to that. So it makes me think, A, of my eldest daughter, and B, of snowboarding.
Good memories, which is the, I suppose, which is important for all of us, is to be finding those anchor points and creating those memories to add to the happiness that we all deserve. As you said earlier, it's about everybody reaching their fullest potential.
Yeah, and I think we forget. I mean, I forget. You know, I listen to music and I think, oh, it's so... I think there are very few people that don't like music. I think Gretchen Rubin, I don't know if you've heard of her, I remember her saying she just doesn't like music, which is is quite unusual, isn't it? I think music is so good for the soul.
It is. It is. Yeah, it really is. And I think that's why it's such an important part of the show, because it just adds so much texture, I think, to the conversation as well. And I think that we don't have to necessarily be die-hard music fans, but essentially recognize that how much it influences our day-to-day and our mood and the effect it can have on it. So I welcome everybody's song choices, and I love the sort of eclectic mix of guests that we've had over the year, really. So it's been wonderful. So before that break, as I say, we did set a new record for The Happiness Algorithm. We punched through that hour mark, which I suspected we would do anyway. But we spoke about leadership, the qualities, the characteristics of both good and not so good, the importance of sort of emotional resilience, a sort of curiosity, an awareness that we apply to self, exploration, understanding, soft analysis, social media and its pitfalls. And obviously we could spend another 3 or 4 days talking about that. But in the world in which we're currently existing, how do we manage it, Fiona?
It's a good question. And I think it's hard. I think, you know, the most important thing is to proactively make space for your slow thinking brain, because everything around us engages with our fast thinking brain, so our, you know, our limbic system, our emotions. If we can make space, and that might be reading, walking, breathing. You mentioned a breath guy who you've had on the show, and I looked him up. Really Richie. Interesting. Really interesting. Yoga might just be walking in a field, looking at the sky. It doesn't have to be complicated, but it's those things that just slow us down and give our brain time to catch up. Give our brain the time to actually digest those cortisol levels and you know, burn them off a little bit. So exercise is great as well, but it doesn't have to be like running a marathon. It can be going for a brisk walk or doing some gardening. Gardening's a great one, isn't it, for slow brain thinking?
Yes, yes.
So I just think it's the simplest way, and I think everything has to be simple, and that's the whole problem, is everything that taps into our fast thinking brain is simple. It's simple to like something on social media. It's simple to go on social media. It's easier to do that, particularly now, than to meet up with friends.
Yeah.
But it's thinking about, And actually, that's the most important thing of all, is just talking, not to yourself, but to someone else, someone that you know is not going to feed you back anything negative or toxic, someone that you can just be with and be yourself and talk to. And that might be on the phone if we've got local lockdowns or what have you. And I think personally, that's so much better than doing it on FaceTime. I think, you know, with grandparents and kids and stuff, it's nice to do a bit of FaceTime. But I mean, I won't go into why. I think there are so many factors that play more naturally to us, of benefit to us, when we're talking rather than staring at a screen.
So talking in person, face to face, if not via a video.
On the phone.
Yeah, on the phone.
Well, I'd say face to face or on the phone. I mean, I think on the phone, because when you're looking at a screen, you set me off on one now. When you're looking at a screen, you're getting an unnatural colour coming out your eyes for a start. You're staring in one position, which we just wouldn't do if we were connecting with people in a natural environment. We sat completely still, which isn't always very good for us. We don't cast our gaze, which is something that we normally do when we're just chatting. We might look up at the sky or we might look to the side. It doesn't mean we're not listening. But when we're on the phone, you can do all those things. You can even walk and talk.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder whether we need to go back a few decades and not have mobile phones, but still have a corded phone. Because if you were then there in that moment and you can't go anywhere because you're attached to the socket, then in a way you then committed to the moment and committed to the person and committed to the call, and then connecting with self that little bit better.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? Because at the beginning of lockdown, I called loads of friends. I was worried about people. I just called lots of people every day. I checked in. And it felt really good because I haven't done it. I've done it for work, obviously, but I haven't had those chats with friends. One of my friends I called, we talked about how when we were at school, we would hang out together all day at school and with other people. And then we'd get home. And as soon as when we were younger, it was 6 o'clock and then it was free phone calls, local phone calls.
Yeah.
As soon as it hit 6 o'clock, we're back on the phone again.
Yeah.
And I know that's a teenage thing because you're very social in the teenage years, but we used to just talk and talk and talk. And at the beginning of lockdown, I spoke to this friend who's still a very close friend, but I hardly ever talk to her or see her, well, not nearly as much as I should. We just chatted and it felt like a release. But that's because that's what we're evolved to do, is to connect to other people. But like you say, it has to be the right people. It's who's on your island.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, look, it has been an immensely strange period, this pandemic, and extremely difficult for some, and I know we've said this before, but through any sort of period of adversity there's always opportunity for growth and learning and understanding. And I feel that when we went into lockdown, we ended up with an abundance of time. So much time was in the day that because we couldn't go anywhere, we were sort of forced to stay in situ. And I felt, personally speaking, at the time, it was something that I'd not felt for quite some time, something that I'd not connected with for since probably being a child, and reminded me of how important that is, that we've got to sort of prevent that flow coming in. And we can get that through conversation, you know, and like you say, beginning of lockdown, and reaching out and speaking to friends with purpose as opposed to a goal. There's conversation with purpose. You mentioned Richie Bostock, who was on a previous show, the breath guy. He said it's about breathing with purpose, concentrating on that breath, understanding that breath and those nuances and how it's influenced by the outside world quite frequently, and then then the internal world. But are we present in our life? Are we present in what we're doing? And is it with purpose? Is there an understanding why we're doing it? Which I think we can all find time and commit to in some way.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the research I was doing for Mirror Thinking, there was one piece I dived into was daydreaming and how important daydreaming is from a psychological perspective for our brain to be able to process things. And yet there's one lady I coach and she's incredibly emotionally resilient. She's a leader in a very tough environment, but a lovely, kind person. And we didn't have a session for a few weeks into lockdown, a coaching session, and we had a coaching session and she said, I feel so relieved. And so, but I went through her schedule with her and I said, are you doing any exercise? Well, I'm walking, but I take a phone call, but that's a work phone call. Mm. Then she had back-to-back meetings all day. Then she'd put the kids to bed and then she'd do work. And I said, there's no space in there for any reflection or any daydreaming, which your brain needs, and which actually before lockdown you were getting because you were walking to your car, getting in your car, driving to work. That was time to reflect. You were getting up and going to the toilet. You know, things like that suddenly have got lost. So I think we've gone from having more time at the beginning of lockdown to less. Mm. And it's really important that we carve that time back out for ourselves. And another thing I do with leaders is I say you need at least an hour, preferably more, a week in your calendar that is reflection time. And that gets absolutely safeguarded. And that for them, that might be reflecting on their own behavior, what they want to do. It might be strategic time, but we need that and we need it whether we're a leader or not.
Mm. Well, it's that primary process, isn't it? It's that periods of time of reflection, but also development of self. It's where, well, it is protected and it's elements of pleasure, you know, very little demand or responsibility as well, because that time that is protected in that way does enable us to evolve. Whereas the secondary element, there's always going to be demand, responsibility, and expectation. I think that's where, again, technology has manipulated our existence in a not-so-healthy fashion because, as you quite rightly said earlier, it's an easy fix. People can dive into social media or go onto their devices and lose themselves for an hour or two, but it's not doing what you're encouraging your clients and the individuals that you're working with. It's not encouraging that deeper level of thinking that is important for our emotional worth.
Yeah, and that deep thinking, you know, it doesn't have to be existential sort of analysis or trying to think about, you know, not even thinking about what meaning means to you or anything like that. It literally can be just allowing your thoughts to wander.
Mm.
That meander that we used to have, you know, when you're little and you're bored in the holidays if you think about, again, if you go back to the way our brain has evolved, it hasn't evolved 50,000 years. And you go back to our ancient ancestors and the world they lived in was they would be walking around and thinking and they would sit around the campfire in the evening and discuss things. What were we doing then and how can we introduce that into our world now? Or not in a sort of like, let's go and live in caves or what have you, but let's look at the world our brain has evolved to live in or think about that and try and align it as naturally as we can. I mean, we do that with food. We're always trying to eat the foods that are most healthy, most natural for us.
Mm.
We should be doing it with how we're saturating our brain as well.
Yeah, and I think that's where we're seeing this growing trend in activities such as like wild camping and wild swimming and going off grid because it reconnects with that almost raw self. But again, going back to what we touched on before about the broken fixed model, we mustn't see it as this all or nothing approach where, you know, if we do that, it's all going to be okay. That's not the fix. That's actually, we go back to what you're encouraging, that protecting time. Sometimes we need circumstantial or situational changes to encourage us to access that bit of that region of the brain that we need. But we can't see it as black and white as, well, if I go yoga once a week, then I'm all going to be okay. actually that gesture to self that we're making has to be ongoing, and we have to understand why we're making that gesture. Otherwise it becomes sort of almost too much of an intervention and a doing aspect, a goal orientated system again. I'll do yoga for 12 weeks and then my world will be okay and I'll be happy. No, it's an intrinsic part of us, a movement, a shift, a subtle shift in who we are and the direction we're heading.
Yeah. And there's, I totally aligned with what you're saying. And there are some interesting papers on emotional resilience, if we're returning to that as a sort of concept. And there's a lot of disagreement over the different elements, or there's a lot of agreement as well. But one thing that I find really useful as an analogy, I'm using my analogies today, but this one is a good one because it's not mine, is a wobble board.
Mm-hmm.
And emotional resilience is like a wobble board. And if you're standing on a wobble board, you have to continually rebalance. It's never going to be just flat. You can't just stand there and go, woo, I've got, here it is, I've finished, it's complete. You have to keep moving tiny little muscles, little movements, maybe a big movement here and there. But you're having to continually judge which way it's going and counter it. And it's life and emotional resilience is like that, because it's saying, You don't get to an end point. Like you say, you don't get to fixed or broken. You are continually needing to fine tune and work on it. But that work can be, it's not hard work. It's not negative work. It's fun. It's, if you introduce the curiosity element, it makes life worth living.
Oh, it so does. That's the headline statement of the show. Life is a wobble board. It actually is a wobble board. It is, as you say, all those little micro movements and the minor muscle groups that are constantly at it. And I think that's where we've got it wrong a lot of the time, is that we're led to believe that if we do X, Y, and Z, it will all be okay. And I see that constant state of chasing the fix, the magic bullet, the cure that will bring with it peace and tranquility. But life is a wobble board. 100%.
Yep.
100%. I you know what? I knew we haven't even done your second song, and we've sort of come to the end of the show. So you know what? We'll play out with your song. Because it would be wrong of me not to play out such a fantastic choice. So we will play out with that song. But I'm going to, if I may, share what I've taken from today's show, which is to be curious, to explore, to apply that light touch to our sort of development of self for our children. But equally, I'm going to apply this to self. We need to nurture our natural mechanisms, and it's important that we don't lose ourselves to the world of social media for all the wrong reasons. And equally, I'm going to say that how we kicked off today's show with regards to leaders, I'm going to say that we need to find the leader within us, that we need to cultivate and develop that level of emotional resilience. And we can enable that through communicating, making space for the slow thinking part of our brain, and constantly, not in an aggressive sense, but acquire feedback, you know, through talking, through stimulating those important relationships, and protect time for ourselves. Our memories are moments that are held in time, whether it be snowboarding, whether it be with our children, whether it be with friends, you know, it's protecting those spaces and not losing sight of what's important to us. And I'm sure there's a whole load there that I'm missing, Fiona, but just in that, you know, that short conversation we've had, there's so much, so much.
Well, I think that's a reflection of you as a great interviewer.
It's very kind. I'm sure many would disagree with that. Well,
I don't think so.
We have to bring it to a close. But I nearly forgot. Before we close, I have to hand it over to our resident expert to see what he felt the show, how it went, and what he thought of the broadcast. So, Mr. Hanks, what did you think of today's show?
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you. I would agree with that, but obviously I couldn't sign off without checking with Tom. So we have to close there. I thank Fiona so much for accompanying me on this voyage. I think it's been an amazing conversation, and we must do it again. I'm sure we will.
Thanks so much for having me on, James.
Well, it was a pleasure. And websites, please. We said books at the top of the show, so please, people, go out there, purchase Defiant. Finding You and Fiona's more recent book, Mirror Thinking, Why Role Models Make Us Human, all about mirror neurons. Crazy, crazy, brilliant book. But websites, please, Fiona, and social media handles so people can follow you.
Yeah, don't, you know, do. Everything's Fiona Murden. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. And then my website is fionamurden.com as well.
Perfect. So as we didn't get to hear Fiona's second song choice, we're going to play out with that today. And what a song choice it is. This is China Moses and Watch Out.
This is not for boys. Watch out, I'm losing faith. I think I need to slow my pace. I gotta watch out with what I'm doing. Full speed towards my goal. We're not complaining, it's just I'm saying. I can't remember his name. I'm feeling stressed out, I could use a drink. Just one shot to help me think. I better stop what I'm doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that I'm used to. I better watch out. Too busy hiding from the pain, but I'm the only one to blame. I gotta watch. I'm looking for a better way. There's got to be a better way. Watch out. I know we all make mistakes. It's hard to get through the haze. I gotta watch out. I'm looking for a better way. There's gotta be 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 a better way. I gotta watch out. I'm starting to sink. So easy to choose defeat. Watch out, I'm pushing my luck. All these years, still chasing a buck. Paranoia got me seeing things. The smoke has gotten to my brain. I'm feeling pressure, but I feel no pain. Am I numb or going insane? I better stop what I'm doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that I'm used to. I better watch out. Too busy hiding from the pain, but I'm the only one to blame. I gotta watch. I'm looking for a better way. There's got to be a better way. Watch out. I know we all make mistakes. It's hard to get through the haze. I gotta watch out. I'm looking for a better way. There's gotta be 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 a better way. Gotta be a better way. Gotta be, gotta be.
Phoenix FM.